While this is loading, let me introduce myself. I'm Alexandra Garcia. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Texas at Austin School of Nursing. And I'm going to talk to you about using cognitive interviews to refine a questionnaire for Mexican Americans with diabetes. I was hoping to be able to jump here. Let's see. I want to acknowledge my co-investigator, Ronald Angel. He's a sociologist at UT Austin. And my research assistant, Sandra Benavides-Valleo, is very helpful in this project. And my consultant, Heather Becker. And also, I should acknowledge Sharon Brown for her contributions to this project. I'm going to talk to you about a portion of a project that was supported by our Center for Health Promotion and Disease Prevention Research in Underserved Populations, a P30 center funded by NINR at NIH. And I should say that NINR and NIH do not necessarily, my comments don't necessarily represent their views. I want you to think about the last time that you filled out a survey. It might have been as a research participant or at a physician's office or a marketing survey. And I'm wondering if you could think about the things that you had to think about when you were answering that survey. Did you know what was expected of you? What did you think you needed to do to complete the survey? Did you know what the survey writers had in mind when they asked you those questions? Did all the items make sense to you? And were your answers among the response choices? Perhaps you couldn't respond in a way that truly reflected your circumstances. When we ask participants to complete surveys, we're asking them to do pretty much three things. We need them to interpret the questions. They need to know what the question's asking. They need to figure out what the particular words and phrases in the survey mean. And if they're non-English speakers or bilingual, they need to do that in two languages, their native language and an English language. They also need to retrieve the information from their memories. That might mean visualizing their experiences from the past, or maybe counting in episodes, or making estimations to be able to answer a question. And then they need to decide how to respond to the question. Some people respond very automatically. Some people are very thoughtful and deliberate in their responses. And they may self-censor their answers. They might decide that the answer is not socially desirable, and so they need to tailor it to what the respondent or what the researcher is going to want to hear. So lots of things can go wrong in our efforts to get the best responses out of our participants, and cognitive interviewing is one way to prevent problems from happening before the survey is even put to use. Cognitive interviewing is endorsed by the U.S. National Center for Health Statistics Questionnaire Design Research Lab at the CDC, and it's a process to explore how people mentally process the information as they respond to questionnaires and to identify problems in item comprehension, memory retrieval, and decision processes. It's also useful to detect non-cognitive problems with questionnaires, such as problems with layout and design, and formatting, and logical problems. For instance, if I asked someone how a particular symptom affected their performance on the job, if they don't have a job, they would have problems responding to that question. The questionnaire that I was revising at the time is the Diabetes Symptom Self-Care Inventory. It was originally developed in 1994 by Sharon Brown and Sandra Upchurch for the Starr County Diabetes Education Project. And I revised it later on for my dissertation use. It's a measure of diabetes symptom experience and management strategies. It includes a symptom list, and it asks people how serious the symptom is to them, a measure of intensity, and asks also about their self-care behaviors that they use to manage their symptoms and about the effectiveness of their symptoms, also their attitudes about symptom management. But there were still problems with the diabetes symptom self-care inventory that we needed to address. One of the problems was about what to call symptoms in Spanish as well as in English. And whether the symptom was serious or not was hard for us to gauge that in our first use of the questionnaire, people said symptoms weren't serious, and yet there were symptoms that we thought were somewhat serious, like blurry vision and dizziness, and so we thought we might need a better way of asking about that. We had a standard list of strategies people might use, home remedies or self-care, lifestyle changes, for instance, but we wanted a broader list and that could also be standardized, and we needed to test a way of measuring symptom effectiveness and format. And as I said, this was part of a larger study that included focus groups, and I've reported on the focus groups findings before, and they were very helpful in teaching us the right words to use, or so we thought, about how people talk about their symptoms and how they felt about them and went about managing them. And it also, and revisions followed the focus group studies, and then we conducted the cognitive interviews with more revisions, and later on we pilot tested our findings. The settings for the study were two regions in Texas. One in South Texas, Starr County borders the Texas-Mexico border. It's 97% Latino. Its per capita income is far below the U.S. average, and many people living above or below the poverty level and with a high unemployment rate. And we also conducted our data in Travis County, Texas, and Central Texas, the home of Austin and the University of Texas and the state capital, with 31% Latinos with a higher per capita income and fewer people living below the poverty level than in Starr County, and below, better than the national average. Sampling for this part of the project was purposive. We were looking for respondents from major segments of the population that we were interested in, so Spanish and English speakers, males and females. We were aiming for 15 to 20 interviews, and we recruited people in Rio Grande City or in Starr County from a registry of people with diabetes from Sharon Brown and Craig Hannes's epidemiological work, and in Austin from community sources with flyers and personal contacts. We had 16 people participate, mostly women, and average age 54. 63 were interviewed mostly in Spanish. Actually, all of the interviews were somewhat bilingual, but 63% were more Spanish than English, or all Spanish, or predominantly Spanish. About half of them were married, and 68% had a high school diploma or more, which was not as typical as with our other studies, that we have fewer people with high school or more education usually, and 44% employed. They had diabetes ranging from 2 months to 31 years, but an average of 10 years with diabetes diagnosed, and 25% on insulin alone or with pills. 69% of them had attended some sort of diabetes class before, whether that was 2 hours or 3 months worth of classes, it varied. And most of them had other medical conditions. Hypertension was the most common. So the cognitive interviews, we conducted 16, most of them 12 in Rio Grande City and 4 in Austin. These were one-on-one interviews that lasted about an hour, face-to-face. We got their informed consent and collected some demographic information, and we spent a lot of time on explaining what we were trying to do, because this is sort of an unusual thing to ask people to not just fill out the questionnaire, but tell us what you're thinking about filling out the questionnaire. So we explained that we needed their help in making the questionnaire better. We used an interview guide that I will explain a little bit more. And we audiotaped these interviews and gave a gift card incentive of $25 for their, it was actually a pretty rigorous interview. So cognitive interviewing questions that we used. We used a warm-up question. This comes from Gordon Willis at the CDC. He says, his example that's used by a number of people who have done cognitive interviews says, picture in your mind where you live. How many windows are there? As you count up the windows, tell me what you were thinking about and seeing. And most of our, actually all of our participants could do this, but with varying degrees of their ability to talk about what they were doing. So one woman, for instance, with less than an eighth grade education said, there are 10 windows in my house, and said, great, tell me what you were thinking about when you came up with that answer, and she said, well, there are just 10. So she wasn't very able to describe in detail what she was thinking. But then there was another woman with some college education who said, okay, I'm in the living room, it's my favorite room, there's a bay window, and there are two other windows, so that's three, and now I'm in the dining room. And so she was able to walk through that process better. It was still helpful to the participants to see this is the kind of thing that we're going to be asking for you to do. And it did bring up some useful information. Do sliding doors count as one window or two windows, and so on. And so we could say, yeah, these are the kinds of things that we're going to want to know about our questionnaire. This is what I've been warned about, the slow slides. Okay, so then the rest of our questions were probing questions. We did them concurrently. So we would ask the participant a question from the survey, and then we would say, and then we would use one of the probing questions, a variety of types of probing questions. And so that's the concurrent way of doing cognitive interviewing. Some people choose to do those questions retrospectively to have them complete the survey first and then go back and ask them about the survey items. But ours was a fairly long survey, and we wanted to get their responses while they were still fairly fresh in their minds. We used mostly prepared and some spontaneous probes. So each the form was prepared so that there was a survey item and then one to three probes after each one. But the interviewers, who was my RA and myself, would also ask spontaneous questions as they came up from the participants' responses. So in general, we were asking things like, what does that word or phrase mean to you? Or can you repeat that question in your own words? What does that mean to you? Was it easy or hard for you to answer the question? And generally, even if it looked really hard, they would say it was easy. So that wasn't maybe a very good question to ask. And we'd ask if your answer was among the response choices. What were you thinking about when you answered the question? Some of our probing questions had to do with translation. One of our symptoms that came out of our focus groups was flushing, and so we had the Spanish translation, ruborearse, and people would say, we don't know what that word is, and so they would say, olas de calor, or hot flashes, basically. So we had a lot of questions about translation issues. Do you know this word? Would you use that word? And what other words would you use? We also asked about cultural appropriateness. Some of our items were about how do you know how your diabetes is doing on a daily basis, and what does knowing how your diabetes is doing mean to you? Is that something you think about? Some of our questions were about sexual symptoms, sexual functioning. Is it okay to ask people about that? So it was a good way to not just report on themselves, but also what they thought the general feeling was. And some global questions after the questionnaire: what's your overall perception of the questionnaire? Another strategy that we didn't use so much that's also another way of going about cognitive interviews is called the think aloud strategy, and it's less structured. It's basically saying, tell me what you were thinking about when you're answering this question, and it can be done concurrent or retrospectively too. That's a good method if you're worried about bias from your interviewer, but it's more burdensome for participants to have to answer that unless they're very articulate and have experience with the topic, for instance. So we didn't use that strategy so much. We used an iterative process. Our data consisted of audio tapes and field notes. We didn't transcribe our audio tapes due to budgeting concerns, but we did listen to the audio tapes and take notes from the audio tapes themselves. We analyzed the data looking for problems and deciding on solutions. We revised the questionnaire. We also revised our cognitive interview probes as we went along, finding that some of those probes were not so helpful, and retesting. A little bit more about data analysis. We looked, some people go about cognitive interviewing analysis in a quantitative way. They like to rate the participants' understanding as adequate or not adequate, or maybe a three-level rating scale. We used a more qualitative method of looking for recurrent themes with the items and deciding whether to keep, drop, modify items, modify the format, modify the instructions. We tested three revisions of the questionnaire sequentially, and we ended up modifying the questionnaire. Had a lot of information about symptoms, names, translation, and wording. We revised the format of the questionnaire and the response options. Some items were dropped, some were added. And in the interest of time, I'll jump to problems with cognitive interviewing. We had a small sample, so not necessarily representative of everyone that we would ask to fill out that survey, so we don't know how representative their comments were. A big problem is that it's time and energy intensive for the participant as well as for us. And we had a hard time deciding how significant each problem was. Every time we did an interview, we felt an urge to revise the questionnaire right now, but and we needed to decide if the item is a problem for only one person or whether that person was speaking what was unsaid by others or whether it was unique to that person. Another problem was that for some participants, it was very frustrating and difficult to have to talk about what they were thinking about it. They just were not familiar with that process. And even we had to go back and say many times, we need your help with this questionnaire. See, these questions maybe aren't so good. Look at the response choices. Is your answer here? And what else would you do? But when we're asking them things, for instance, if we're asking about how you felt in the last month or have you had this symptom, and you ask, what does the last month mean to you? Does that mean from October 4th to November 4th? Does it mean October? People would say, I don't know how I know, I just know. And they could tend to get frustrated, some people. And if they didn't have a symptom, they might not know how to explain it. Another issue that came up. Even so, we found cognitive interviewing to be really invaluable for revising our questionnaire. One symptom that came out of the focus groups was hollow in connection with hypoglycemia. But when we were asking about it on a list of symptoms out of context, people didn't know whether you're talking about a physical feeling of feeling hollow or empty or an emotional feeling of feeling alone and empty. We ended up getting rid of hollow. But we learned a lot about our phenomenon that way. We got to clarify, does it bother you versus does it worry you? We ended up going with, is it important to you? Because there were so many variations on that. And we realized that we needed much more colloquial translations. Entumecimiento is a way of saying numbness, but people didn't use that word in Spanish. They said they lost sensation or like your leg going to sleep, sleepiness. We also learned that we needed to make our instructions and explanations much more conversational. Even though we were doing this in a one-on-one interview, we needed to explain the context of the question that we're asking. So a long explanation of do you do monitoring was more about, so how do you know how your diabetes is doing day to day? Some people do monitoring, some people do this and that, and balancing out whether you're leading the person versus explaining what it is you want to know from them. Most of the time, I think when we give surveys, we're worried about our participants' burden, and we're more abrupt in our questionnaire giving than many of our participants prefer. They wanted time, not to be rushed. They ended up telling their story in their own context and eventually getting down to, oh, that symptom was actually 2 years ago after my husband died, but no, I really haven't had it recently. But they needed to be able to get all of that story out first. So I think that's the end of my time. I wanted to thank our participants and the people in our field office. And on the slides, if you have access to them, I listed a lot of references. There are many publications now that have talked about using cognitive interviewing in their questionnaire redesign. So there are lots of places to look for help. And the Willis publication is free from the CDC. It's a great how-to manual to do cognitive interviewing. So I would say use cognitive interviewing, but recognize that you may need to tailor it for your particular population. Thanks very much.